Chapter 3. Damn. He's gone to be sure she is gone with that sailor who bought her, and little Elizabeth Jane. We walked here, and I had the firmity, and rum in it and sold her. Yes, that's what's happened, and here I'm one. Now, what am I to do? Am I sober enough to walk, I wonder? He stood up, found that he was in fairly good condition for progress, unencumbered. Next he shouldered his tool basket, and found he could carry it. Then lifting the tent door he emerged into the open air. Here the man looked around with gloomy curiosity. The freshness of the September morning inspired, and braced him as he stood. He and his family had been weary when they arrived the night before, and they had observed but little of the place, so that he now beheld it as a new thing. It exhibited itself as the top of an open down, bounded on one extreme by a plantation, and approached by a winding road. At the bottom, stood the village which lent its name to the upland and the annual fair that was held thereon. The spot stretched downward in two valleys, and onward to other uplands, dotted with barrows, and trenched with the remains of prehistoric forts. The whole scene lay under the rays of a newly risen sun, which had not as yet dried a single blade of the heavily dewed grass, whereon the shadows of the yellow and red vans were projected far away, those thrown by the fellow of each wheel, being elongated in shape to the orbit of a comet. All the gypsies and showmen who had remained on the ground, lay snug within their carts and tents, or wrapped in horse cloths under them, and were silent, and still as death, with the exception of an occasional snore that revealed their presence. But the seven sleepers had a dog, and dogs of the mysterious breeds that vagrants own, that are as much like cats as dogs, and as much like foxes as cats also lay about here. A little one started up under one of the carts, barked as a matter of principle, and quickly lay down again. He was the only positive spectator of the hay trusser's exit from the wagon fair field. This seemed to accord with his desire. He went on in silent thought, unheeding the yellow hammers which flitted about the hedges with straws in their bills, the crowns of the mushrooms, and the tinkling of local sheep bells, whose wearer had had the good fortune not to be included in the fair. When he reached a lane, a good mile from the scene of the previous evening, the man pitched his basket and leant upon a gate. A difficult problem or two occupied his mind. Did I tell my name to anybody last night, or didn't I tell my name? He said to himself, and at last concluded that he did not. His general demeanor was enough to show how he was surprised and nettled that his wife had taken him so literally, as much could be seen in his face, and in the way he nibbled a straw which he pulled from the hedge. He knew that she must have been somewhat excited to do this. Moreover, she must have believed that there was some sort of binding force in the transaction. On this latter point he felt almost certain, knowing her freedom from levity of character, and the extreme simplicity of her intellect. There may, too, have been enough recklessness and resentment beneath her ordinary placidity to make her stifle any momentary doubts. On a previous occasion, when he had declared during a fuddle that he would dispose of her as he had done, as he had replied that she would not hear him say that many times more before it happened, in the resigned tones of a fatalist. Yet she knows I am not in my senses when I do that, he exclaimed. I must walk about till I find her. Seize her, why didn't she know better than bring me into this disgrace, he roared out. He wasn't queer if I was. 'Tis like Susan to show such idiotic simplicity. That meekness has done me more harm than the bitterest temper. When he was calmer he turned to his original conviction, that he must somehow find her, and his little Elizabeth Jane, and put up with the shame as best he could. It was of his own making, and he ought to bear it. But first he resolved to register an oath, a greater oath than he had ever sworn before. And to do it properly he required a fit place and imagery, for there was something fetishistic in this man's beliefs. He shouldered his basket and moved on, casting his eyes inquisitively round upon the landscape as he walked, and at the distance of 3 or 4 miles perceived the roofs of a village, and the tower of a church. He instantly made towards the latter object. The village was quite still, it being that motionless hour of rustic daily life which fills the interval between the departure of the field laborers to their work, and the rising of their wives and daughters, to prepare the breakfast for their return. Hence he reached the church without observation, and the door being only latched he entered. The hay trusser deposited his basket by the font, went up the nave till he reached the altar rails, and opening the gate entered the sacrarium, where he seemed to feel a sense of the strangeness for a moment. Then he knelt upon the footpace. Dropping his head upon the clamped book which lay on the communion table, he said aloud, "I, Michael Henchard, on this morning of the 16th of September, do take an oath before God here in this solemn place, that I will avoid all strong liquors for the space of 21 years to come, being a year for every year that I have lived. And this I swear upon the book before me, and may I be struck dumb, blind, and helpless, if I break this my oath." When he had said it, and kissed the big book, the hay trusser arose, and seemed relieved at having made a start in a new direction. While standing in the porch a moment he saw a thick jet of wood smoke suddenly start up from the red chimney of a cottage near, and knew that the occupant had just lit a fire. He went round to the door, and the housewife agreed to prepare him some breakfast for a trifling payment, which was done. Then he started on the search for his wife and child. The perplexing nature of the undertaking became apparent soon enough. Though he examined and inquired, and walked hither and thither day after day, no such characters as those he described had anywhere been seen since the evening of the fair. To add to the difficulty, he could gain no sound of the sailor's name. As money was short with him, he decided, after some hesitation, to spend the sailor's money in the prosecution of this search, but it was equally in vain. The truth was that a certain shyness of revealing his conduct prevented Michael Henchard from following up the investigation with the loud hue and cry such a pursuit demanded to render it effectual, and it was probably for this reason that he obtained no clue, though everything was done by him that did not involve an explanation of the circumstances under which he had lost her. Weeks counted up to months, and still he searched on, maintaining himself by small jobs of work in the intervals. By this time he had arrived at a seaport, and there he derived intelligence that persons answering somewhat to his description had emigrated a little time before. Then he said he would search no longer, and that he would go and settle in the district which he had had for some time in his mind. Next day he started, journeying southwestward, and did not pause, except for night's lodgings, till he reached the town of Casterbridge, in a far distant part of Wessex. 3. The high road into the village of Wegdon Priors was again carpeted with dust. The trees had put on, as of yore, their aspect of dingy green, and where the Henchard family of 3 had once walked along, 2 persons not unconnected with the family walked now. The scene in its broad aspect had so much of its previous character, even to the voices and rattle from the neighboring village town, that it might for that matter have been the afternoon following the previously recorded episode. Change was only to be observed in details, but here it was obvious that a long procession of years had passed by. One of the 2 who walked the road was she who had figured as the young wife of Henchard on the previous occasion. Now her face had lost much of its rotundity, her skin had undergone a textural change, and though her hair had not lost color it was considerably thinner than heretofore. She was dressed in the mourning clothes of a widow. Her companion, also in black, appeared as a well-formed young woman about 18, completely possessed of that ephemeral precious essence youth, which is itself beauty, irrespective of complexion or contour. A glance was sufficient to inform the eye that this was Susan Henchard's grown-up daughter. While life's middle summer had set its hardening mark on the mother's face, Her former spring-like specialities were transferred so dexterously by time to the second figure, her child, that the absence of certain facts within her mother's knowledge from the girl's mind would have seemed for the moment, to one reflecting on those facts, to be a curious imperfection in nature's powers of continuity. They walked with joined hands, and it could be perceived that this was the act of simple affection. The daughter carried in her outer hand a wiry basket of old-fashioned make, the mother a blue bundle, which contrasted oddly with her black stuff gown. Reaching the outskirts of the village, they pursued the same track as formerly, and ascended to the fair. Here, too, it was evident that the years had told. Certain mechanical improvements might have been noticed in the roundabouts and high flyers, machines for testing rustic strength and weight, and in the erections devoted to shooting for nuts. But the real business of the fair had considerably dwindled. The new periodical great markets of neighboring towns were beginning to interfere seriously with the trade carried on here for centuries. The pens for sheep, the tie ropes for horses, were about half as long as they had been. The stalls of tailors, hosiers, co-opers, linen drapers, and other such trades had almost disappeared, and the vehicles were far less numerous. The mother and daughter threaded the crowd for some little distance, and then stood still. "Why did we hinder our time by coming in here? I thought you wished to get onward?" said the maiden. "Yes, my dear Elizabeth Jane," explained the other. "But I had a fancy for looking up here. Why? It was here I first met with Newson on such a day as this." "First met with father here?" "Yes, you have told me so before. And now he's drowned and gone from us." As she spoke, the girl drew a card from her pocket and looked at it with a sigh. It was etched with black, and inscribed within a design resembling a mural tablet were the words, "In affectionate memory of Richard Newson, mariner, who was unfortunately lost at sea, in the month of November 184, aged 41 years. And it was here," continued her mother, with more hesitation, "that I last saw the relation we are going to look for, Mr. Michael Henchard." "What is his exact kin to us, mother?" "I have never clearly had it told me." "He is, or was, for he may be dead, a connection by marriage," said her mother deliberately. "That's exactly what you have said a score of times before," replied the young woman, looking about her inattentively. "He's not a near relation, I suppose?" "Not by any means. He was a hay-trusser, wasn't he, when you last heard of him?" "He was." "I suppose he never knew me," the girl innocently continued. Mrs. Henchard paused for a moment, and answered uneasily, "Of course not, Elizabeth Jane. But come this way." She moved on to another part of the field. "It is not much use inquiring here for anybody, I should think," the daughter observed, as she gazed round about. "People at fairs change like the leaves of trees. And I dare say you are the only one here today who was here all those years ago." "I am not so sure of that," said Mrs. Newson, as she now called herself, keenly eyeing something under a green bank a little way off. "Here." The daughter looked in the direction signified. The object pointed out was a tripod of sticks stuck into the earth, from which hung a three-legged crock, kept hot by a smoldering wood fire beneath. Over the pot, stooped an old woman, haggard, wrinkled, and almost in rags. She stirred the contents of the pot with a large spoon, and occasionally croaked in a broken voice, "Good furmity sold here." It was indeed the former mistress of the furmity tent once thriving, cleanly, white-aproned, and chinking with money, now tentless, dirty, owning no tables or benches, and having scarce any customers except two small whitey brown boys, who came up and asked for ha'porth, please good measure, which she served in a couple of chipped yellow basins of commonest clay. "She was here at that time," resumed Mrs. Newson, making a step, as if to draw nearer. "Don't speak to her, it isn't respectable," urged the other. "I will just say a word, you, Elizabeth Jane, can stay here." The girl was not loth, and turned to some stalls of colored prints, while her mother went forward. The old woman begged for the latter's custom, as soon as she saw her, and responded to Mrs. Henshaw Newson's request for a pennyworth with more alacrity than she had shown in selling six pennyworths in her younger days. When the so-eyed Dyson widow had taken the basin of thin poor slop that stood for the rich concoction of the former time, the hag opened a little basket behind the fire, and looking up slyly, whispered, "Just a thought o' rum in it, smuggled, you know, say two pennorth will make it slip down like cordial." Her customer smiled bitterly at this survival of the old trick, and shook her head with a meaning the old woman was. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.